Beach easy.
I learned that my personal relationships are much more important than my professional relationships, and that my number one priority is always going to be my family. And that still can be tough at times, you know, especially when the demands of speaking here or speaking there or doing some events on the weekends. But I'm lucky that Cindy, my wife now, is all in on doing stuff with me like that. But yeah, communicating and making my family priority is the most important thing to me now. And that's something I learned that I did not do enough of in my first marriage.
Welcome to Life's a Beach and Then You Die. From personal growth and self-discovery to challenges and victories, we discuss it all. Join us as we dive into the extraordinary stories of ordinary people all the way to the end.
Welcome to Life's a Beach and Then You Die. I'm Julie Ellis, and today I'm with local weather personality Ed Piotrowski, who's very well known in the Myrtle Beach area as ABC 15's chief meteorologist. Growing up as a military kid, his early life played a big part in shaping who he is today.
Believe it or not, I was born in Hawaii. My dad was in the Marine Corps for 30 years, so we were stationed in Hawaii, and my brother and I both born in Honolulu on the Marine Corps base there. Unfortunately, I was 2 years old when I moved away, so I don't remember a thing about Hawaii. So that's on a bucket list to get back there.
Where did you grow up then? I know you moved around a lot. Sure. So tell me what that experience was like.
So we moved from Hawaii and then eventually to California and then back to New Jersey when my dad was a recruiter in the Marine Corps during the Vietnam War, which is a very difficult thing, and ended up going to grade school in New Jersey, then eventually did some elementary and middle school in North Carolina, and did high school in South Texas.
Oh, wow.
And then went to North Carolina State University for my degree in meteorology. So, yeah, all over the place.
That must have been very difficult. I mean, it's hard growing up, especially, you know, at certain ages, to make friends and feel grounded. You know, did you ever get that, or how did you get through that?
It was it wasn't easy. As you know, you made new friends, and then literally 2 to 3 years later, it was time to move on. Either they left because of another duty station, or we got stationed somewhere else. So every 2 to 3 years, you land in a new spot, and you basically have to make new friends. And I think it helped develop my personality to be more outgoing because, you know, you'd reach out to the kids across the street and next thing you know, you guys are friends and just having a good time before another 2 to 3 year cycle comes up. You know, kind of heartbreaking every 3 years or so to have to say goodbye to friends that, you know, over time kind of fade away, unfortunately. Although to this day, you know, many years after graduating high school, I still keep in contact with some of my grade school and high school friends.
Tell me about your parents. What was your dad like?
So dad was not the great Santini. You know, if you've ever seen that movie, he wasn't a real hardcore Marine. He worked in the air wing with Cobra helicopters for 30 years. He started out as a search and rescue with the helicopters and then became what they call a maintenance chief and a quality assurance chief, just making sure the helicopters were good to fly. And he did that for many years, and he was strict. I mean, he'd give us the evil eye in church if we were talking or getting out of line, but he was not the great Santini, where he was a mean dad. He gave us the birds and bees talk and all that good stuff. And it was, he was a good father. And he's in, you know, as I mentioned, he's living with me now. So he's doing well.
Did you have those moments like you see on videos, like on social media, where dad comes home and just like so elated to see him? What was that like?
Those videos are amazing, and they're exactly what happens. So several times when the squadrons are coming home, all the families gather on what's called the flight line, which is right there at the base. I can't remember the name of it now, the hangars. So we would all gather there, and then you would see this massive array of helicopters coming in, and probably 15 to 20 of them, and everyone's excited. They all land, they all get off the helicopters, they line up, and then they're given the order that they're free to go, and then it's just a mad rush of military men and women coming at you and families heading that way, and they all meet in the middle, and it was just incredible to see my dad coming home each time. It was really neat.
About how many times did you go through that?
That was four times at least.
Yeah.
My dad was deployed in the Mediterranean Sea for 6 months at a time, three different times. He was stationed in Okinawa during the Gulf War for a year and a half. He was only supposed to be there a year, but he got extended because of the Gulf War. So we look at it like at least 3 years of our lives, my dad was long gone because of the military.
What do you think you learned from him?
Oh, gosh, I learned a lot about integrity. My dad, no matter what was going on with work, was always a man of integrity, and he is a man of faith as well. So I learned a lot about growing in my faith through him and being somebody that no matter what's going on in your life, to be somebody of integrity. And that's what I try to live every day.
That's awesome. Not everybody learns that from a parent.
No, I'm very lucky that I have great parents.
Yeah. And tell me about your mom.
So my mom is awesome. She's a little more laid back, if you will. Whenever we wanted something growing up, we'd always go to mom first, hoping she'd say yes and not get the go ask your father thing. But she also grew up in New Jersey, you know, just a couple towns over from my dad. And she worked hard because my dad was deployed quite often, at times up to a year and a half. And so it was my mom and four children. And so she was great at keeping us in line, keeping us going with school and our chores and everything like that. Again, she wasn't really strict, but she was forceful when she needed to be.
Ed's parents were great examples of integrity and hard work. Although the life they lived wasn't easy, it was worthwhile and taught Ed many valuable lessons about life and family.
Being a part of the military life certainly had a huge influence on my life. There was the strictness, if you will, of the military, that was a cool thing in my life because it kept me on the straight and narrow. I didn't get in a lot of trouble at all. I mean, I think the worst thing we ever did was stay out all night long and, you know, hang out at the pier or what have you on the base. But you're pretty well protected on a base as well. But there, you know, growing up was fun in the military bases. It was sad, and it was kind of defining when you would see your parents go off, not knowing when they would come back, especially as a child. You know, you knew your dad was going away for 6 months, but you didn't quite know where he was going.
Yeah.
And if he was going to come back, if he was going to be in a combat situation or not. So I can remember quite a few nights as a child. I can't remember the grade. I would say somewhere between third and fifth grade, where I'd go to sleep wondering where my dad was and whether or not he was going to come back. And that was a bit taxing at times, you know, on my brain,
yeah.
Just because you're wondering about if you're going to see your father again.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I remember that pretty vividly.
Yeah.
Back in the day when he was deployed, everything was written letters. You know, it would take weeks, if not a couple of months, to get those letters back. I think military folks in this day and age, you know, with FaceTime and video calls, it's a lot easier to keep in contact. But
yeah.
I still have all those handwritten letters from my dad as well, making
That's
sure
nice.
We were doing well in school and making sure that we were being behaved, you know. And it was kind of funny when we were growing up, my brother and I could get into some trouble with each other. And my mom would harass us about, wait till your father hears about this. So we were bad for the first 5 months of the six-month deployment. Then we tried to really straighten up for the 6 months, hoping we'd get a good report to dad. So,
what kind of kid were you like otherwise? Did you do sports?
Played basketball in high school. Didn't play football. I was always afraid of hitting somebody head-to-head, you know, that I was going to become paralyzed or what have you. But played basketball, played baseball. Played baseball my freshman year, but I was taunted so much as a freshman, I just decided not to do that anymore. But and we went out fishing a lot because we lived on the Gulf Coast at the time, and played sports in our yards, rode bikes, all that good stuff that, you know, in a sense, all American kids do mm-hmm. as children. So
you said at one point that you got bullied.
Right.
Do you recall situations of being bullied where it just kind of broke you or made you go home and cry? Like,
Was it
that bad?
When I was in third or fourth grade, I had really big ears. My ears stuck out a lot. I just kind of grew into them. So I was teased about that all the time. And, you know, your self-confidence, your self-worth just bottoms out. You just kind of, a lot of times when that happens, you just want to avoid being around people or certain situations because you know what's going to happen,
yeah.
kind of a thing. When I was in high school, I really enjoyed baseball, as I mentioned. So my freshman year, I was in a fifth period, which instead of PE, they had baseball there. And because I was a freshman, you know, they constantly bullied me. I remembered almost every single day they would drag me around the infield, and I would go to sixth period dirty like Pigpen. And, you know, people, why are you so dirty?
Drag you?
They literally grab my feet and they would drag me like a rake around the infield. So I would be filthy the entire time.
What were you doing then? Were you laughing or were you like crying?
That's what I chose.
Were you mad?
Instead of crying or getting mad about it, there's nothing I could really do, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I couldn't, you know, tell seniors to stop because then I'd get beat up probably. So I just laughed it off like I was having fun with them. But I dreaded it every day knowing what was coming. So I got out of that and never played baseball and decided to play basketball.
After graduating high school, Ed had a decision to make about his career. He briefly considered following his father's footsteps, but his fascination with the weather won out, and he decided to pursue that passion instead.
Did you ever consider going into the military yourself growing up?
Almost. When we were stationed in Corpus Christi, Texas, I knew I loved the weather, but I also loved the idea of becoming a pilot. And it just so happened that we had a retired three-star general in the Air Force that went to the church we went to on the base. And he also, one of the congressmen went there as well. So I was this close to going to the U.S. Air Force Academy. But I quite frankly chickened out. I didn't want to go all the way out west as my mom and dad were stationed back east. So
that's why you chickened out? You didn't want to be away from mom and dad?
I think I was immature at that age. I just didn't want to be that far away. So I ended up opting to go to NC State to get my degree in meteorology. And I don't have any regrets in life, I don't think, but I wonder what it would have been like if I could have been a pilot, a jet pilot. I think about that all the time, especially when I flew with the Blue Angels
back
in 2000.
Yes. Oh, neat.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah. So, well, you said you liked the weather, like as a kid. When did you start noticing the weather and like thinking about it? Seriously.
I remember in grade school, I think I was in third grade, I was fascinated by the weather. And back then, you basically had three channels to watch, ABC, CBS, and NBC. That was it. There was no internet. So every night, I'd have some paper maps, and I'd draw the forecast on the maps, and I'd take it to school the next day, and I'd present the weather.
What age?
About third grade or so.
No kidding.
So it was fun, and I never thought I would do television, but it was kind of funny because if the forecast was wrong and somebody pointed it out, I would blame the people on TV. So it's come full circle now that I get blamed when the weather's not good. So.
I love it.
It's cool, though.
What do you think it is about the weather? Like, what attracts a small child to, like, care or think about that?
I think a lot of times, and I've seen this a lot, especially with grade children, they just have a fear of the weather until they understand it. Tornadoes scare children. Hurricanes scare children. And it's just because you see these ominous images and videos on television, and you hear the horrible stories of what they can do. And I think kids kind of take that in, and they associate everything with tornadoes and hurricanes is really, really bad. And so I enjoy teaching them, hey, if you do these things, you don't have to be afraid. You can you can just be educated on the subject and respect tornadoes and hurricanes, but you don't need to fear them.
So you were young and you had some fear or interest in like the damage weather could do, but that led you to wanting to investigate the science of all of that too. So did you get into that in like a really cool, like nerdy way, like in high school where you were just going to go to weather camp or like whatever? How did you explore that?
Well, long before I even liked weather, I was a nerd. So there's no question about that.
I love it.
You're not nicknamed Special Ed, you know, unless people think you're a nerd of some sort. But anyway, I mean, I just remember really being fascinated by the weather. When I was in South Texas, it was extremely rare to get any snow or ice, but I remember the forecast called for sleet one night. And so I literally stood out by the light pole for like 6 hours waiting to see something and never saw anything, of course. But I just always have loved weather. We didn't have the internet back when I was growing up. So it was books a lot of times or what I was taught in my science classes. So I really, really enjoyed that. Never, ever thought I would do television until I actually graduated high school and ended up meeting a meteorologist in Eastern North Carolina who invited me to the TV station. And I was able to work with the graphics and got me up in front of the board. And I'm like, I'll never be able to do this because I sounded so Southern. Thunderstorms are coming, you know.
Oh, did you really?
Really, really bad.
You had to work on that.
I had to work on all that. And I don't know, I just got more comfortable over time. And I really enjoyed talking about the weather and telling people about it. So I ended up taking that as a career path.
Well, when did you get your first job then in meteorology being on TV?
So I graduated from North Carolina State University in 1990. And I started in New Bern, North Carolina, did weekends for a year there. And then I was promoted to the morning job for 2 years. So I was there for 3 years. And in January of 1994, I was promoted to the chief meteorologist job at our station here in Myrtle Beach. And this is where I've been for the last 30 years.
When you first started in TV, did you struggle a little bit with having the confidence to do that? Oh. I've done a lot of on-camera stuff, mm-hmm. and now it's second nature to
right.
me. But when you start out, especially if you had been bullied, like, did you have any of that playing in your head? Like, am I good enough? Do I look good enough? How do my ears look on camera? Like, were you like in that mindset at all when you started?
No doubt. I can distinctly remember when I got promoted to the morning job and even the weekend job. Every morning I would call just pissed off that I didn't get this right. I didn't get that right. I shouldn't be doing this anymore. I can't speak clearly, you know. But it's like riding a bike. You just got to get used to doing it and get used to that space. And over time, you just get better at it. But boy, those first couple of years, I was always down on myself and never could find an actual weathercast that I liked.
But how did you deal with that? Did you just like get harder on yourself and work harder? Or did you kind of let go of the perfectionism about it all, or kind of a combination?
That's a great question, because I didn't quite know how to handle it, but I had some friends that I had gotten to know in the business who had been in the business for several years. I think of my friend Eric Thomas, who's was at BTV in Charlotte, and Steve up there in Charlotte as well, and some other folks in Houston and Louisiana who I would send my stuff to, and they would help me not beat myself up. I'm like, you're going to make mistakes. And my mantra is, everyone makes mistakes. It's not the mistake you make. It's how you recover that matters.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that really, the light bulb went off there. I'm like, okay, if you make a mistake, laugh it off and move on. And gradually, I accepted that's the way it was. That's what I was going to do. And it just made me better on television, because I let go of that pressure, if you will, and it just was naturally flowing at that point.
Ed's career was thriving. He loved life in Myrtle Beach and was growing more confident in his skills as a meteorologist. During this time, he was married to his first wife, Deborah, but found himself more focused on work than on his relationship. Over time, they began to drift apart.
So we met in Jacksonville, North Carolina. We were going at the time, before I went to NC State, Coastal Carolina Community College, not at all related to Coastal Carolina University. So we had met there and dated a while, and then we ended up getting married. And, you know, she was there as I started my first job in television. And yeah, and her dad was in the Navy. And so we had that military connection.
Mm-hmm.
So, pretty cool.
How long were you married?
We were married for 20 years before we divorced. And it was one of those situations where when we moved to Myrtle Beach, I went all in on my job. And, you know, when you're young, because I was in my mid-20s, you know, it's like you're consumed with that. You want to do well. You don't want to fail. Well, all the time I'm doing that, I'm kind of neglecting my relationship with my wife. And she had a morning job. I had an evening job. And over the course of 10 years, kind of just grew apart. And and I really wanted to work on it. We went and saw a counselor, but it just wasn't going to work out. So I made a decision there. I'm like, all right, this is the way it's going to be. I'm not going to sit here and beg or hope that it happens again. I'm just going to learn from the mistakes that I've made.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad that, you know, it was sad, probably this one of the saddest times of my life to have that happen after 20 years, because you're used to that person being around. But I'm glad that I didn't have any bitterness with it, or very short amount of time with that. Moved on. She's doing extremely well. I couldn't be happier for her, and I'm happier than I could ever imagine now.
What did you learn?
Gosh, I learned that my personal relationships are much more important than my professional relationships, and that my number one priority is always going to be my family. And that still can be tough at times, you know, especially when the demands of speaking here or speaking there or doing some events on the weekends. But I'm lucky that Cindy, my wife now, is all in on doing stuff with me like that. But yeah, communicating and making my family priority is the most important thing to me now. And that's something I learned that I did not do enough of in my first marriage.
When did you meet your second wife?
So Cindy, I have known for 25 years. So I've done a lot of charity events where we would do golf tournaments, and people would ask me, could you get certain things to help with the silent auctions or, you know, whatever it may be. And Cindy works at the Carolina Opry. So twice a year I would call her and ask her if we could get some tickets or what have you. And so we just, you know, had a very casual friendship, you know, over that time. So I remember reaching out to her after my first wife left and asking her for tickets. And I said, by the way, I knew she was a person of faith too. I said, and totally just said this because I knew she was a person of faith. I said, you know, you don't mind praying for me. My wife has left and I'm just going through some tough time right now. I feel comfortable saying that. At that time, I thought she was getting married. She had what appeared to be a relationship on Facebook and was engaged. And, you know, she said she would. And I said, good luck with your wedding. I see it's coming up fairly soon. And she told me that, she goes, no, I broke that off. It just didn't feel right to me. So I just had to let it go. Like, oh, and so we just started chatting, you know, and then began dating. And 3 years later, we decided to get married. So
that's
pretty neat
amazing.
How that all worked out.
Yeah.
3 years later, we were, after I'd asked Cindy to marry me, we were sitting on the back porch, and the date that we were going to get married is October 9th. And so about 2 weeks before that, there's a disturbance coming off the African coast, and it eventually becomes Hurricane Matthew in 2016. So as it's getting closer, I'm like, look, I'm going to have to stick around for a while and see how this all pans out. I said, why don't you guys go to the mountains? We were going to get married on Banner Elk. So they went to, it was just a family gathering, her parents, my parents, close relatives. You guys go up there and I'll join you as soon as the hurricane passes. So Matthew comes in on the 8th and does a little more damage than I think a lot of people expected. So power's out. I get off the air that night at 11 o'clock on the 8th, and I go home, and, you know, this day and age, you have a garage door opener. I don't have a key to my house, but the power's out, so I have no way to get in. Oh. So I have to go to the backyard into my window, and I break the window to get in, crawling through shards of glass. Like, this is the way it's going to end. I'm going to fall and impale myself on glass. They're going to find me 3 days later, and I don't make the wedding. But I was able to get in, was able to get a shower with no power, took a nap for about an hour, came back on my wedding day morning, had to do the morning news, then got off the air, caught the first flight out of Myrtle Beach. My best man picks me up in Charlotte, Eric Thomas, and drives me to Banner Elk, got there at 4 and got married at 5 o'clock. So we made it happen.
Oh my gosh.
It was divine intervention, I think, yeah, to be able to get me there. Everything had to go perfectly well for me to get there. So
yeah. Well,
cool.
There you go. That's a good answer.
Right.
How long have you been married now at this
point? So we've been married since 2016, so we will be coming up on 8 years in October.
Ed learned a lot from his relationships with both his first and second wives. He was a changed man, and family became everything to him. Around this time, his parents began to struggle with their health. After a lot of contemplation, Ed decided it would be best for them to move to Myrtle Beach so he could take care of them.
When did you make the decision to take your parents in?
So it was, and I don't, this was not a situation where my first wife was doing this so she could get out of the relationship. I don't believe that at all. She just felt the same way I did, that, you know, my mom was laid up in a bed, had a broken ankle that she didn't even know she broke. And, you know, the healthcare up there was just not what it was down here. So she suggested, what do you think about, we were looking to build a house anyway, building a house and bringing your mom and dad down. You know, on the surface, that sounds fantastic, you know, and I'll never regret making that decision, but there's a lot that goes into that every single day. But, you know, I wouldn't change it for the world. We decided, okay, we'll do that. We talked to my mom and dad. And I was shocked that they agreed to do it because their life was on the military base and being near the military base. But they were like, yeah, let's do it. So, you know, like they say, the rest is history. We decided, okay, let's do this. We got a plan together how the house was going to look and be handicap accessible because my mom's in a wheelchair. And, you know, it just worked out. She never made it into that house, though. She left before she ever stepped foot in the house when we moved in. So that was a blessing as well, because I had no memories in that house with her, if that makes
right.
sense. So
no, I can appreciate that.
It was brand new to me. So that definitely helped me as well moving forward. And I think being focused on my parents and their well-being after Deborah left was a big deal as well. So
what is their relationship like right now?
It's, you know, they're in their early 80s, so sometimes they pick at each other, you know, but they do a lot of things together. Luckily, my dad bought a handicap van, so it's easy to wheel mom into the van. And, you know, the toastery in Carolina Forest is basically their cheers. Everybody knows who they are there. So they love going there, and they're involved in their church as well. So that's been a huge blessing for Cindy and I, because they're not depending on us to do everything with them. They've got friends now and places to go. So they still get out and do a bunch of things, you know, whether it's go to the theater or go out to dinner or go to their church with their friends. So that helps tremendously.
And then you're watching your parents age and lose their faculties and lose their physical abilities.
Right.
Is that something you've thought about? And again, this is a general question,
sure,
because we all go through it. How has that affected you?
Because they've lived with me for the past 10 years, you don't notice it on a daily basis. But when you think about where we are today and where they were 2 or 3 years ago, you see a definitive decline. You know, my mom, for the most part, is still the sweetest person on the planet. She forgets some things sometimes.
Yeah.
My dad has always been incredibly sharp, just a very, very smart person. And he still is. But I notice there are times when he forgets some real basic things. And because he's a proud Marine, it really bothers him when he does that. And I'm just like, Dad, it's okay. It happens to all of us. I'm 57 and I forget words on television all the time, kind of a thing. So it's a little tough because I know he's beating himself up about that. I've done many times where I've showered my mother or helped to change her after, you know, certain disasters, as you can imagine. You think you never could do things like that, but you do them and you realize, okay, I can do them. It's not out of my realm of possibilities to do something like that. And you just do it because you care, and that's what they need at the time. And for me, it's always about maintaining their dignity. You know, I don't want them to ever feel embarrassed or what have you. So we always try to just help out. And Cindy's amazing with help. I mean, she doesn't have to do anything, but she does probably more than I do.
That's
pretty
nice.
Pretty cool. Cindy and I have talks often about, all right, We made a promise to my mom and dad, we'll never put them in a home unless we just simply cannot take care of them anymore. We'll bring all the caregivers in that we need so that you're always comfortable here at home. And so far, so good with that. But I worry that there's going to come a point where we've got to make that decision.
Yeah.
And I just know when that happens, I think their decline is going to be a much faster decline.
That's what happens.
Yes.
Well, I just think it's a testament to the way you were raised and your parents that you have this much compassion for them.
Oh, yeah.
For giving you all they gave you. You know, it's kind of a beautiful thing. And not everybody does that with their parents or their family. So
people have asked me about it. And I'm just like, really think about it. Because if you are the least bit selfish, this is going to drive you crazy. You're not going to want to do it. And it's going to make you angry a lot. But there are frustrating times with it. But like I said, I don't regret ever doing that because I feel like they're on permanent vacation, and I really feel moving them down here has extended their life. And, you know, they've been able to live, you know, a good life down here for the past 10 years instead of dying in North Carolina.
Living with his parents has helped Ed realize the fragility of life. Watching your parents age is never easy, but this isn't the only health challenge the Piotrowski family has faced. In 2008, Ed's brother Matt was diagnosed with cancer, and life for his family changed in an instant.
So Matt was our youngest. He was what we call a cruise baby. And what that means is, you know, Dad was deployed for 6 months. Dad comes home and Mom and Dad go off to a hotel for a couple of days, you know, to be alone or what have you. So Matt was born from that, and he was our youngest, 10 years younger than me, and had a great sense of humor and always made us laugh, you know, was constantly doing stuff outside and trying to hang with us. And we always looked out for him. And he just had a great sense of humor growing up.
And what happened to Matt?
So back in 2008, it's been about 15 years now, he had been suffering with back problems for over a year. And I remember even at my 40th birthday, he was complaining about how bad his back hurt. And we just kind of attributed to he was an electrician, always working and moving around in various buildings on Camp Lejeune and New River Air Station. And we just figured that's what it was. I mean, he was, you know, 29, 30 years old. You wouldn't think anything else.
Right.
So he eventually went to the doctor. And they did a CAT scan and an X-ray and found that he had a big tumor in his lower back. And so it had gotten so big that they also saw that he had the cancer had spread to his liver and to his, what was the other thing? His lungs, because he had started to cough up blood. So I remember that call vividly because he was such a jokester. I thought he was kidding with me, you know, when I first heard it. And so that was on a Thursday. So after the shows on Thursday, I decided I got to go up and see him. We got to figure out what's going to go on. They decided that on Monday they were going to do a biopsy just to see what kind of cancer it was. So Thursday, he calls me. Monday, they do the biopsy. And on Tuesday, something happened where I can't remember the name of the disease or what have you, but it was he became septic, sepsis, I think it was. Oh. And so the tumor was so big that when they cut it, it had let a lot of bacteria flow into his bloodstream. And so we found out on Thursday and unfortunately passed away on that Tuesday, just 6 days later. And
you mean from the initial diagnosis?
Yes. From the time they first saw it on the CAT scan and x-rays.
Oh my gosh.
6 days later. And it was, he didn't die of the cancer, if you will, taking its toll over time. It was the cutting of the tumor when they were doing the biopsy that caused him to have an infection run through his bloodstream.
Oh,
that's what did it. So,
were you close to him?
We were close. Matt and Mike, we were all very close growing up. And even though there was a 10-year difference between us, Matt would come on down to Myrtle Beach a lot. I've always invited him to play in the golf tournaments that we had. You know, if they gave me a team, I'd always invite my brothers first. And, you know, always had a good time, you know, with him because he was so funny. He was a big guy, too. So he could beat the both of us up very easily. So, but yeah, we were all really a close family.
That happened so quickly.
Yes.
It must have been quite a shock for you.
It was incredibly, just an incredible shock. I mean, I can remember every single detail of the phone call that I got that Matt had passed away because it was, again, I was at work. We went up for the weekend. So I found out on a Thursday. We went up over the weekend. We knew the biopsy was going to be done on Monday, but we went home Sunday night. And then we got the call that Matt's been rushed to the hospital. And the next call at the office was Matt had passed away. And I just remember going into my news director bawling and saying, I got to leave right before the newscast. And so I did. And then my wife and I went up to Jacksonville, North Carolina, where we went and met all the family. And it was really as heartbreaking as it was for us just seeing my parents. You know, my dad being a Marine doesn't cry. It's one of the few times I did see him cry, you know, during that time when we all showed up and also at the funeral itself. For Matt, which I delivered the eulogy for, which was very difficult to do, but I was able to get through it. But it was, I just remember how shell-shocked I was with that. But one of the things I had learned in church, which gave me peace, was that, you know, your life is a dot and eternity is a line. So I knew that no matter whether you had a year on this planet or 100 years, at least I believe that I'll see them again. And it's a short amount of time compared to eternity.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what's gotten me through it. I mean, there are still times when you know, it feels like yesterday that it happened. And then other times it feels like it's been 15 years, you know.
Yeah. When you went the weekend before he passed, what kind of things did you talk about?
So we, of course, we didn't have any clue that he was going to die, you know, that quickly. We knew it was really serious and he didn't have a good prognosis because of how far it had spread. So we, you know, talking to Matt, how do you feel? I think he was shell-shocked too. He didn't really know how to feel, but we talked him into doing a journal just to journal his journey of what it was going to be like as he went through treatment and so on and so forth. And, he put one entry in there. It says, well, my cancer journey begins tomorrow. We'll see how this all pans out. And that was the only one he has in there. And so, yeah, I mean, I can get emotional just thinking about that because you just, it all comes flooding back.
Yeah.
When you see what he wrote. And they went out. We all went to dinner, you know, over the weekend. They got family pictures done over the weekend. I had, because I don't see my brother all the time, you know, several months would pass. And I had noticed when I got there over that weekend that he had no doubt lost weight and looked more gaunt than I'd ever seen him. And that was a pretty telltale sign, too, that things were not good. So, and then I, to this day, I remember pulling away from my mom and dad's house because that's where they lived and seeing Matt at the glass door just waving goodbye. And little did I know that that wave goodbye was the last time I'd ever see him alive. It was crazy.
Well, I'm sorry for you because that's just a terrible thing to go through to lose somebody close to you and then watch your parents because that's the unimaginable thing, right, is losing a child.
Oh, sure.
losing your parents is tough, but it's kind of supposed to happen that way.
Exactly.
When you outlive a child, that's a whole other kind of pain.
Oh, yeah. And it's, you know, my mom's much more sensitive than my dad. So she's, you know, there'll be times when we'll come home and she's looking at pictures of Matt, because that's just what a mother does. You know, 15 years later, she still will occasionally, like, you know, wonder what could have been, what would have been, kind of a thing. And that's tough.
Ed's perspective on life helped him heal after his brother's passing. He's learned a lot about what it means to be dedicated to those you love and strives to live each day with that in mind. Now, Ed does what he can to share the joy he's found with others, especially through his work as a meteorologist.
I do roughly 250 appearances, if you will, a year, which can range from emceeing an event to taking part in an event, going to visit schools.
Yeah.
And I just love the fact that I can use my television platform for what I think is good, you know, training somebody or teaching somebody about weather to make them more weather aware, or lending my experience and talents, if you want to call it that, to MC an event. You know, I just love that. And if it brings joy to people, then it brings joy to me. And I think, honestly, and it sounds cliche, but that's what this world needs, is more joy and things like that. So it's like, even on my Facebook page, I have this rule that I will put nothing but positive things on it. Of course, can't, you know, it's hurricane, you got to deal with that, but no politics, none of that stuff. So maybe I'm living in a bubble, but that's the bubble I choose to live in.
You're right. The world needs that. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, your thoughts and the things, you know, you put out, or we all do, we have a choice every day, whether we're going to be happy and kind or whether we're going to be, you know, grumpy. And we spread that energy, and that energy is real, and it affects people.
I think that's some of the greatest compliments I get will be from people. Thank you for your positivity. Thank you for bringing awareness to our event. It's been we appreciate it, you know, and I love that, because it's, you know, using my platform to just make something a little bit better, perhaps.
Ed hopes that his story can help others understand why it's so important not only to live in the moment, but also to keep an eternal perspective on life. He's found peace in helping others and couldn't imagine life any other way.
If you've been inspired by this story or any others, please take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review.
We don't just get away at the beach, we get together. Because no matter what floats your boat, we're floating right along with you. With over 2,000 restaurants, live music all day and night, and endless attractions, Myrtle Beach was made for having fun and beaching easy. Welcome to 60 miles where you belong, the beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Plan your trip at visitmyrtlebeach.com.